morning. Can I just take, was that not fantastic? I mean, how sweet. So last week, we started a series where we talked about grief and why it's actually important in our faith and in our living in this world, because there are two truths that are absolutely real. One is that life is tragic and God is faithful is the second, and we hold both of those together. We don't deny one for the other. And if life is tragic, then we need to figure out how does grief fit into our worldview and how we live as Christians. But today, I want to start from a different point. And so if I were to ask you, what do you think that throwing the football in the front yard, cuddling on the couch, and drinking hot tea have in common? You don't have to, just see if you can figure it out. All three of those things bring me joy. Because if I'm throwing football in the front yard, I'm with my little boy who loves to throw the football. If I'm cuddling on the couch, I'm with my little girl and she loves to cuddle on the couch. And if I'm drinking hot tea, I'm by myself. And if or with my wife. I love good hot tea. I wish I was a coffee person. I'm not. If I'm drinking coffee, I want coffee that's basically hot chocolate that sat next to a pot of coffee once. Do you know what I'm talking about? And in my home, we have a lot of loose leaf tea. We have these mason jars on shelves that are labeled and they're full of tea. And if it's okay to say this, my kitchen totally looks like a marijuana dispensary. You know, we just have jars of, you know, dried plants in them. Anyway, you know, there's these things in my life that bring me joy, little bits of joy. And I think everyone's into the project of joy, or at least I hope they are. If you would, just turn to the person next to you and just share one or two things that bring you joy. Ready, go. Okay, what were some things that you heard or said? What? Grandkids. Oh, great, great. Yeah, grandkids. What else? Shopping. Friends shopping. Coffee. Where are the coffee people at? Yes. Yes, I am not on your team, but I understand you. Yeah. What else? What were one or two other things? Dogs? Yeah, where's the dog people? Yes. Yep. No, not cats. Fine, cats. Candy bars? At 2 a.m. Candy bars at 2 a.m. Amen. Oh my gosh, after Halloween, I love Halloween because my kids get all this candy for me. You know? And they don't know what I take. I mean, really. Anyway, but okay, so joy. Don't we all want joy? Isn't that what we're about? Isn't that what we're here for? I think everyone would put that at the top of the priority list on how to get it. But how do we get it? How do we get it? I want to look at Jesus, who I think starts in a place that we may not normally start when it comes to joy. But Jesus, who we believe is God in the flesh, he's giving us wisdom from the outside. And often I think it's worth tuning into Jesus, maybe most particularly when he offers us wisdom that we would not have created for ourselves. When he gives us an insight that to us sounds upside down or backwards, that is the moment to lean in, because that's the moment we really get some wisdom from the Lord. Right? The stuff that lines up with what we already think, that's great. But when he gives us something that makes us turn our heads and wonder, what? That's the thing that we need to figure out how to follow Jesus around, yeah. And so when he talks about joy, I just want to look at one passage in particular, starting in John 16, verse 19. Jesus saw that they wanted to ask him about this, so he said to them, "Are you asking one another what I meant when I said, 'In a little while, you will see me no more, and then after a little while, you will see me'? Very truly, I tell you, you will weep and mourn while the world rejoices. You will grieve, but your grief will be turned to joy. A woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come. But when her baby is born, she forgets the anguish because of her joy that a child is born into the world. So with you, this is going to be the same way you live. Now is your time of grief. Does anybody know that? Like down in their bones, they've got some grief they're carrying around. Now is your time of grief. But I will see you again and you will rejoice and no one will take away your joy. When Jesus goes to teach about joy, joy, the thing we all want, one of the things he takes time to do is to say we have to start with grief. Thanks, Jesus. Why don't you come to the party again? I mean, like, that is not the kind of thing we want to hear someone talk about when we're trying to pursue joy. What does grief have to do with joy? But again, he consistently says things like this, this pattern of living, this way that he says this is how creation is ordered because this is how God's heart is ordered is on about every page of the Bible in one way or another. For example, in the Sermon on the Mount, he says this, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Maybe we could say they will have joy. Yeah? Now, here's what I'd like to do, which is organizing a sermon a little bit differently than normal. If we could just take the words of Jesus that we just heard, and I'd like to kind of like set them on the table for a second. And then I want to talk for a little bit about joy and talk through a little bit of theory on how joy works. And then at the end, I want to come back to the words of Jesus and see if they line up or have transformed for us and how we see them and hear them in any way. All right? All right? Okay, good. All right. I need you guys with me today. Okay, so joy is one of the things that I have talked about a fair bit and spend probably a fair bit of time thinking about also. And one of the things that happened to me a little while back is I ran across a definition for joy that I finally liked. I really didn't like most of the definitions for joy that were floating around in Christian culture. I thought they sounded over-spiritualized. I thought they diminished what happiness is, you know, as if that's kind of like this cheap thing, you know, and I finally ran across one of my favorite thinkers, a guy named Miroslav Volf. You do not have to know how to spell his name. That will not be on the final. It gave me a definition for joy that I've been running with and I think is fantastic. Joy joy equals meaning, an experience of meaning plus pleasure. When these two things combine, we have joy. Not just pleasure and not just meaning, but when we have meaning and pleasure in the same place, we have joy. Me throwing the football in the front yard with my son is not just pleasurable. It also has meaning and therefore brings me joy. Now, it probably doesn't come as any surprise. Our society has gone all in on pleasure, haven't we? We have more pleasure available to us than, get this, any society in the history of humanity. More pleasure available to you, right? How many streaming services are there to pick from? Disney Plus, anybody? Yeah, big thing this week. You know, see, there's our society for you. Good. New streaming service. Ah, right. I mean, like, this is like, whoa, my gosh. Well, I get another place that I can endlessly experience pleasure and entertainment. Yeah? You know, and how many are there to pick from? Restaurants. If you leave here and want to go to lunch later, there are more restaurants than you can even pick from. If you want to get cereal at the grocery store, your problem is not where can I get the cereal I want. Your problem is there are so many options and you have to pick from all the options. Are we tracking? Okay, so pleasure, we have gone in on pleasure all the way, whether it's success or whether it's sex or whether it's what we eat or whether it's what's in our bank account. And we're banking on at some level that if we just get enough pleasure, if I can just get enough money in the bank account, if I can sleep with who I want to, if I can watch what I want to, if I can sleep as long as I want, whatever, then we're going to experience something that has meaning. But is it any wonder that with all of the pleasure we have available to us, there are so many people that are still miserable? Pleasure alone isn't doing it. We need to add meaning to the equation so that we can get to joy, right? Makes sense? So I want to talk for a little bit about this piece because this is where we struggle. Now, meaning, if I could, give me an object that brings you some joy, some object that brings you joy that you own. Not even talking about people, but maybe something you own. Your hammock. Oh, that's fantastic. Kurt. Kurt, yeah. So, okay, so hammock. I'm betting that when you are in your hammock, part of what you're doing is you're escaping a little bit, right? You're getting kind of out from the world and a little bit of crazy, and you're sort of laying down in there, and you get to unplug, right? Yeah. Okay, so meaning is always about context. So that hammock experience for Kurt isn't just pleasure. It also is about the context of him getting away from kind of the craziness of the world. Something that brings us joy in our house is I have this pocket watch that's my great-great-grandfather's, Thomas Jefferson Bratton. And when their house burned down because it was in his pocket, it was the only item of any value that made it out of the home. And it got passed down through my family, and now it just gives me some joy to see it in my own home, right? Sometimes my kids play with it. Yeah, meaning, whether it's the hammock or whether it's a 200-year-old pocket watch, part of the reason why it has meaning is because of a context or because there's a story attached to it, right? There is something going on that is meaningful. And pleasure without meaning, or we could say pleasure without a story attached to it that has meaning, doesn't get us to joy. On Friday night, my son spent the night with his friend, and they woke up, and my son's friend introduced him to cinnamon chip pancakes. I didn't know this was a thing. Sounds good to me, right? Now, this is apparently in their family something that's kind of a tradition. I think maybe even the grandparents did it with the parents, and the parents do it with the kids, and it's like this thing, yeah? And it is my son's friend's like favorite thing. And so he got Elijah at the table, and when he took his first bite of cinnamon chip pancakes, he goes, "So what do you think?" And Elijah said, "They're good." And he was like, "Try another bite." Right? Because listen, for my son, cinnamon chip pancakes, pleasure. Yeah, carbohydrates with sugar dumped on top. Woo! But for my son's friend, they also had meaning because of a story, because of context, so it involved joy. Now, so if we're going to talk about a story, all good stories have a couple of things in common. Not all stories are good, but every story that is has a few things in common. Every story starts with someone who wants something and goes through difficulty to get it. Kurt wants to relax, so he takes the trouble of getting outside, setting up his hammock somewhere so that he can get it, right? This is every story that you have ever seen on a movie screen or read in a book that matters to you. This is why people watch sports, right? Somebody, a team, wants something to win, and they're going to go through the game in order to get it, or maybe it's to win the season. This is why people come home after hunting and tell stories about hunting. You know what's not a good hunting story? I walked out my front door, there was a deer standing there, I hit it with a bat, and we ate it. Right? There's no difficult, well, welcome to my mind, I'm sorry. The hunting stories that get told are the ones about how hard it was, about how far out you had to go, about how you had to stay out all night in the tree stand and it was super cold, right? I mean, you know, that's what gives it a story. That's the one that you hang up on the wall, right? Because it has meaning. Maybe even one of the earliest stories that gets passed around in our culture, one of the first books that people read is Green Eggs and Ham. Right? There's someone, do you remember the guy on the right? Do you remember his name? Sam I Am. Yeah, he wants something. Do you know what he wants? He wants his cat friend? What is that guy? He wants him to eat green eggs and ham, and then at a level that should require a restraining order, he goes through something difficult, basically badgering this guy and going through all his excuses in order to get him to try it, right? And that produces meaning. That is a story that has endured, oddly enough, because the guy finally caves. This is how, in a sense, the human soul is wired to acquire meaning. And we have to have a story of meaning plus pleasure to experience joy. Now, sometimes when we see this in other people's lives or we read about it somewhere else, this is something that's great. We enjoy it. We enjoy seeing someone go through the difficulty. But when it's our story, what do we want to skip? I want something, and I want to get it. Brett wants to lose 10 pounds and wants to wake up tomorrow and it be true. Right? I don't want to have to go through something to get it. But this is where maturity is grown, and we all know it. Let's say you have a child who says, I want a hamster. I want a hamster for Christmas. I'm going to name it Nibbles. Nibbles the hamster. Isn't that adorable? Now, a good parent would know that if we get the child the hamster, that is going to be pleasurable. But if my child is going to not just have pleasure, but have joy, we need to give the child some meaning. So that means my child wants the hamster, so the parent is going to say, you have to go through some difficulty to get it. You either have to save up your money, or you have to agree to clean out the cage, and to put food in there, and water. You have to play with the hamster. You can't ignore the hamster when you don't want to. And what the parent is doing is they are requiring the child to go through difficulty to get it so that the child can mature past just pleasure and experience joy. Now, does the kid always see it that way? No, right? They see the parent as evil. As soon as they don't want to clean the cage or play with Nibbles the hamster, the parent is seen as bad or wrong. Yeah? Now, so a parent sometimes will not only allow difficulty to produce meaning and joy in a child's life, but sometimes will even require it. Will even require it. This is the part that I want to talk about. Because this is where the whole thing hangs. How we respond to difficulty changes everything about our life. And there's ultimately two tracks that we can run on when we're talking about how we deal with difficulty. So hang with me. When you experience difficulty, the first thing that happens is we have an awareness. We have an awareness that something is difficult. I have not blown anyone's mind yet. Hang on, that becomes an important step later. After awareness, what happens is we have feelings. I feel that that is difficult. I don't like those feelings. Does anyone in here like the feeling that something is difficult? I don't like being sore. I don't like waking up early. I don't like being hungry. How am I going to respond to the fact that I need to wake up early, work out, and eat less? Yeah? And so we have, when we become aware of the difficulty, then that produces feelings in us. Whether this is you at the office at work, or this is you with your friends, or with your family, or with some goal you're trying to achieve in your life, or something tragic happens to you that just falls out of the sky. We have feelings. And that means that we have needs. Contrary to popular belief, you need more than just food, water, air, and shelter. You have emotional needs that matter. Yeah? But we are often trained to think that if we have needs, emotional needs, that we have done something wrong. Right? But all of us have emotional needs. The only way to not have emotional needs is to not have feelings, and the only way to not have feelings is to not be aware of them. Now, one of the challenges with this so far is that often we are so busy, we aren't even aware that we have feelings, and therefore we aren't aware that we have needs. And our lives are so packed to the gills, and we have so many options to fill every crack of our lives that we don't even have space for awareness. Some of us numb our awareness with addictions. Some of us numb our awareness with success, right? One is praised by society, one is looked down upon, but they're both the same move. We're both trying to get away from our awareness of our feelings and our emotional needs because we don't want to deal with difficulty. So when after we have needs, what that reveals to us is that we have a lack of control. That there are things in the world that affect us. That we are affected, that life can get to us. We talked a fair bit last week about how Jesus let life get to him, yeah? And so get this, God chose to not be in control of every situation in his life. He did. Isn't that crazy? And from here, what we are trained to do as a society, the next step is to take control. And people that take control of those around them, I'm not just talking about being active in a situation, I'm talking about the taking control that means that I don't have needs, don't have feelings, that I'm not aware of the fact that I'm going through difficulty, right? Take control, and that always leads to isolation. We are trained in our world to get on a certain train. This is the Hogwarts Express. I borrowed it from my kid. Straight from platform 9 3/4. This movement is the movement of power, which is something that we often find heroic, unfortunately, in our world. Now, here's the lie. What we say is that you can get aboard the power train, where you take control of your life. And inside of your boxcar, you can live however you want. You can celebrate the things you want to celebrate. You can be about the things you want to be about. You can decorate your boxcar with diplomas. You can decorate your boxcar with drama. You can decorate your boxcar with whatever it is that you're into, with entertainment. You can decorate your boxcar with your hunting trophies. That's all, it's all good stuff, right? I would decorate my boxcar with electric guitars. And pizza. Yeah? You can live your life however you want, right? But what we think is that that's freedom. We think that if I can live my life however I want inside my little boxcar, that that is freedom. But if we are chasing control, we are all aboard the same train that goes to the same place. I know one rule about trains: they go where the tracks lead. That is predetermined. And it is predetermined if you and I try to control the people around us, we will always end up at a destination called isolation. Whether you control the people around you by being the teacher's pet and by playing by the rules, and that's how you take control, or whether you take control by being the rebel, those are just two boxcars that look different next to each other on the same train going to the same destination. Right? How do you control people in situations when they get difficult? I control people by being nice. Did you know you can control people by being nice? If you didn't, I can teach you. If I can get you to like me, I can usually get you to do what I want you to do. Yeah? But that makes you not a person to love. That makes you someone to control. Right? And I'm going, some people control the situation around them through aggression. That's how they take control of their world. And this move of power, and I know when we say power, we tend to think about like world leaders. I'm talking about the person who's going to be in the home at Thanksgiving that needs to control everyone around them emotionally. Tracking? Power plays out everywhere all the time, and we have a choice. Are we going to be about power, or are we going to be about something else? C.S. Lewis has a fantastic quote that I want to spend a little bit of time on. It's rather lengthy, and that last little bit will be up on the screen. He says this, "To love at all is to be vulnerable," which means give up power, right? "Love anything, and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, avoiding difficulty, you must give your heart to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully around hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell." Now, aside from the fact that I had to look up perturbations, what he's saying is if you want power, you will end up alone. Luckily, Jesus came and offered us something different, something better. And it shifts here. See, Jesus says that instead of taking control when we experience our needs and our feelings, we are supposed to surrender. We are supposed to let life get to us and acknowledge that we are not God, that we are not in control, that we do not have all the power to control the people around us and shouldn't, or even control ourselves. And in surrender, there is always some level of grief because we're giving up something that matters. Often we're dying to the thing that we wanted, and grief changes the thing that we even want. It takes us deeper and changes our story, and it changes the thing that we want. I don't want that. I want something better, deeper than that. More than being with that person, I want to love that person, and that might mean that I don't get to be with them. Right? More than getting that job, that might mean that I need to die to that, that I need to surrender, that I'm not going to get that job. What I want is something better than that. I want to be a good person. Yeah, and grief has a way of changing our whole story. This is the way of love that Jesus offers us. When I was, a couple of years ago, I was kind of expanding my role as a pastor, and I had always kind of been able to figure things out and had been able to be good at the thing that I was doing. And people around me seemed pretty happy, which makes me happy. And then I hit this wall where I couldn't figure out how to solve the problem in front of me. The time and energy and stress that I was putting into it, trying to get control, were not working, and it was breaking me down because I couldn't get control. I was trying to and couldn't. The word that was killing me was the word better. I thought that I was better than this. I thought that I was going to be a better pastor. I thought I was going to be a better boss. I thought I was going to be better at being smart and strategic. And I hit this ceiling where I realized I'm not always going to be better. And when things started to get better in my own soul was when I surrendered to the idea that I don't always have to be the best person in the room. That I don't always have to be in control. I don't always have to be smart enough. I can, guess what, ask for help and say, I don't got this. And that caused some grief in my heart and changed my story. It changed me from wanting to be the hero, I still struggle with that, from wanting to be the person that everyone loves, to wanting to be someone that loves well. And that grief gave me the gift of changing my story and saying, even if I can't get the thing I want, I'm going to want something better than that, deeper than that, stronger than that. If I could just use another analogy, this is kind of like a ship instead of a train. Ships are difficult because they are deeply affected by the world around them. The weather doesn't matter so much to the train. It matters a lot to the ship. But the ocean is wide open. There is actual freedom on a boat. The train, everything is determined ahead of time. This is the way of love that invites us into difficulty, that gives us meaning and gives us joy. If we could look at maybe at John, the women who stood at the feet of Jesus as he died, near the cross of Jesus stood his mother. His mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Listen, the other disciples chose the way of power and control. Peter wanted to control his story by saying he didn't know Jesus. I don't even know the man. The other disciples wanted to control their story by running away. Some people, their method of control is avoidance. But Mary, his mom, went in love towards grief and stood at the cross and watched him die. Next, in Matthew, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting opposite the tomb. In their grief, they went all the way to where they buried him, and everyone else, in an effort to gain control, didn't go. But just a few verses later, this happens. After the Sabbath, at dawn, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb, and guess what they found? It was empty. Because they entered their grief, they got to change their story. My story is not just that I want to see Jesus live, but something better than that. I want to see God's faithfulness in the middle of this tragedy. And they got to be the first witnesses at the resurrection. The people who went to the cross were the people who went to the empty tomb. Because they went to grief, they got to go to joy. Get it? If they had skipped entering grief, they would have missed the resurrection of Jesus. And just because this has been floating around in the Christian community for a little bit, it's just worth saying that for this brief moment where he gives these women, he says, go home and preach that I have risen. Until they get back and tell the disciples, the only preachers of the gospel in the whole world were two women who decide to enter into grief and therefore were received in joy. Jesus gives us this model with his own life. Hebrews 12 says this, let us run the race with perseverance that is marked out for us. Fixing our eyes on Jesus. So how he ran this race is how we're gonna run the race. The pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. This is how we get joy. We enter into the pain and difficulty and even grief. And when we avoid it, we're not just avoiding pain, we're avoiding joy itself. But when we go into grief and let it change our story in love, the thing that we're after, what we find is we have meaning to spare. And when that meets with the pleasure of God's heart, we finally have joy. Let me just close with reading scripture and then a few questions. Jesus saw that they wanted to ask him about this, so he said to them, are you asking one another what is meant when I said, in a little while you will see me no more, and then after a little while you will see me? Very truly I tell you, you will weep and mourn while the world rejoices. You will grieve. But your grief will be turned to joy. A woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come, but when her baby is born, she forgets the anguish because of her joy that a child has been born into the world. So with you. Now is your time of grief, but I will see you again and you will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy. A couple of questions as we wrap up. First, where are you pursuing meaning and not just pleasure? Where are you pursuing meaning and not just pleasure? Two, where have you had to go through something difficult? Three, do you know how you try to get control and power? We've all got it. How do you try to get control and power? That's probably worth sharing with the people around you so that they can call you on it when you're doing it. Fourth, where do you need to surrender and grieve? Let that change what you're after so that you can have meaning and joy. So let's pray. Lord Jesus, you do not live like we do. We would rather have a God that would just give us pleasure, pull us out of our pain, and rescue us from it. But that is not who you are. And deep down, I'm glad. You call us into grief so that you can give us meaning and joy. Help us to be like you, Jesus. Emmanuel, God with us in our tragedy. And you are faithful. Amen.